Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson. I usually start these classes off with a disclaimer, which is, hi Hildy, which is that we cannot possibly cover the entirety of a person's life, especially one of these gedolim, in the 45 minutes to an hour that we have together. And it's particularly true for the Lubavitch Rebbe, not to say necessarily that he is this or that compared to other people that we've covered, but it is to say that there is so much documented evidence, or I would say documented, you know, experiences with the Lubavitch Rebbe. There's so much we could talk about, and it's just not possible that we could talk about everything. Not even close to talking about everything. But we'll give somewhat of an overview, some interesting points here and there. I'll try to mix in some of the specific, unique stories so that people get a flavor for those experiences. But obviously, there's tons to watch. You could even watch it online. Obviously, he's a more modern character than we usually have. So there is what to look at. First, we have to thank our sponsors. I believe it's the Siegelbaum's. No sheets here. They threw them out already. They're so quick to throw all the sheets out. Thank you to the Siegelbaums for sponsoring. Let me just pull it up here quickly. Hold on.
If it said the announcements, it is the Siegelbaums.
Yeah, it is. I just want to...
Veronica and Miriam
Siegelbaum. Sponsored Le'iloi Nishmas. Le'iloi Nishmas. Do you have it there?
Yeah. In memory of their husband and father, Jimmy Siegelbaum, Rafal Yitzchak Shimon Ben Chaim Eliezer, and their father-in-law and grandfather, Louis Siegelbaum. Chaim Eliezer Ben Yitzchak Yisrael.
Thank you, Emirates Hashem. Our learning, Shibi Le'ilay Nishmasam, an elevation for their souls. Thank you to Siegelbaum for sponsoring this class and the other Bate Medrash classes. In order to appreciate who we now call as the Rebbe, or the Rebbe, you have to go way back. You have to go way back to the beginning of Chassidus. Obviously, you have to go back all the way to Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. But in terms of appreciating who he was uniquely, so you have to go back to the Baal Shem. The Baal Shem Tov, obviously, we know in the 1750s starts Chassidus. His main disciple, although it is debated, is understood to be the Maggid of Mezrich. Others will say that the Rav Yaakov Yosef of Polon might have been his main disciple. He doesn't get as much credit. But Tolos Yaakov Yitzchak tells us a lot about the Baal Shem too, and unclear what the dynamic was between them, but for a different time. The Maggid of Mezrich has many different main disciples. One of his main disciples, one of the prodigies of his when he was getting started as a young Talmud, was a man by the name of Shner Zalman of Liadi. Did we speak about him yet? I think we spoke about Shner Zalman of Liadi. You might recognize that first word, that first phrase, that first name, Reb Shner. Shner sounds a lot like Schneerson. All the names that you've heard, Schneuri, Schneerson, Schner, all comes from the original Rebbe, also known as the Alter Rebbe, also known as the Baal HaTanya, also known as the Shulchan Aruch Harav. He starts what we now know as Chabad. It was not yet called Lubavitch because he lived in Liadi, right? His son, Rav Dov Ber Shneuri, named after his father, Shner, is who brings it to, who brings the movement to Lubavitch.
What time period is that?
So this is the late 18th century. Rav Dov Ber Mezrich dies in the 1770s, I want to say. And Rav Shner Zalman of Liadi gets his start in Chabad already while the Maggid's still alive. So we're talking pretty soon after that, the end of the 18th century. Rav Shner Zalman of Liadi was actually sent by, if you remember the story, he was sent by, if I'm not mistaken, he was sent by the Maggid, along with Rav Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk, who we'll talk about in a second. Some say, I think it might have also been Rav Shmuel of Nicholsburg. Either way, Rav Shneur Zalman and somebody else, another main Talmud of the Baal Shem, of the Maggid, go to the Vilna Gaon. I don't know if you remember the story. I believe this was in 1771. April of 1771. They go to meet with the Vilna Gaon and try to make peace. The Mesnagdim and the Hasidim. This is early on. I mean, Hasidus has only been around for 20, 30 years at this point. They're trying to make peace already. It's already sort of boiled up. There is a lot of history here with Shabtai Tzvi and other things, other movements that have tried to use Kabbalah in this way or that way. Not getting into the history now, but either way, Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi was one of the trusted, confidants of the Maggid of Mezrich. So he's sort of, and he's sent off to basically Russia, right? This is north of Vilna, away from sort of the main center of Hasidus, which you say is Mezhebezh or Mezrich, right? That general Polish area over there, Polish Ukraine. So he starts, and the reason that's important is because the battles of Hasidus that are going on in the main headquarter region, right, to the south or the southwest over there in Poland and Ukraine, they have strength in numbers. But up in Lubavitch, by the Balatanya, so they have to fight for themselves. And this is where all those imprisonments happen, because they're in a different, this is in a different country. In Russia, they deal with the Tsar, and they're fighting it alone. So that's why a lot of the drama around Lubavitch and Chabad specifically happens over there and not other places, because they don't have the numbers that other places do. Either way, so now we're up to Rav Dov Ber Shniuri. He is known as the, anyone know? Before today, I wouldn't be able to. Tell you this. I mean, I'm familiar with all the names, but I don't know who's who. So he's known as the Mittler Rebbe, I don't know why the Mittler Rebbe, but either way. So what? He would what? Oh, a future shear. The Jews, we don't know much. Either way. So Rav Dov Ber of Shniuri. Gives over the Hasidus to not his son, he didn't have sons, he gave it to a son-in-law. This is actually somewhat controversial. He gives it over to who we now know as the Tzemach Tzedek. You might know that phrase, the Tzemach Tzedek. That was the original Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson, right? That's the Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson, the original, the OG, as the kids say today. So Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson, it was controversial because I believe he was the youngest of the son-in-laws. He was the youngest of the son-in-laws, and the other sons-in-law thought that they were the rightful heir to Lubavitch, the Chabad. And they actually break off. I don't know if people know this. There are other sects of Chabad. They're not very popular. They sort of probably get all mixed up together. I'm not even sure if there is much of a Hasidus otherwise. I'm trying to remember. There's like Chabad Kiputsk or something like that. Anyone know? Kitupsk? There's another type of Chabad. Either way.
You mentioned it briefly, but it's very, very, very small.
So you might be asking, wait a second, how's his name Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson? I thought he was a son-in-law. Yeah, he took the Schneerson name. Back then, last names weren't as concrete. So he took his mother's name, the dynasty's name, Schneerson. So that's Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson. And then he gives it over to, I believe he gives it over to his son, also a younger son, if not his youngest son, Shmuel Schneerson, who then gives it over to his second son. Notice no one's giving it over to their first son. So that's Rav Shmuel. I forgot his name. I want to say maybe it's the Maharash. People call him the Maharash. Either way, so Rav Shmuel Schneerson gives it over to Rav Shalom, I think it was Rav Shalom Ber. He's known as the Rebbe Rashab. Have you ever heard that phrase, the Rebbe Rashab? We're getting into the close to the 20th century here, the end of the 19th century. The Rebbe Rashab gives it over to his only son. So these were direct sons. The last three were direct sons, Schneersons. The Tzemach Tzedek was the son-in-law. The next three were actual literal sons. So he gives it over to Rebbe Rashab, and Rebbe Rashab gives it over to his son, Rebbe Yosef Yitzchak, his only son. Rebbe Yosef Yitzchak, also known as the, I always stumble on this word, but the Friedeker. The Friedeker means the previous, which is only a name you could really give retroactively, because now there's only, you know, the end of the line was this, the Lubavitch Rebbe, and therefore the previous one can only possibly refer to the penultimate one. You don't know it's the penultimate one until you don't have any more after the last one. Either way, he's called the Friedeker Rebbe. That's Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson. And Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson has three daughters, no sons. He has no sons. And his oldest daughter, I want to say his oldest daughter, Shana, unfortunately was taken in the war along with her husband's. The next daughter we'll talk about, her name was, I believe, was Chana. She was married to, what's his name, Gurara? I want to say, is that what the name was? Gurari. And then there's Rav Menachem Mendel, who's married to the last daughter, whose name was, anyone know the Rebbetzin's name? You'll know it when I say it, because you probably know other Rebbetzins with this name. Chaimushka. Right, the Rebbetzin Chaimushka. So Chaimushka is the other daughter. So we'll get a little bit into this soon, but as I just mentioned, there are no sons, only sons-in-law, and that causes some controversy. The parts of Chabad that Chabad doesn't like to talk about. But let's back up. Now we know sort of the lineage from the Baal Shem all the way down to Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson. Let's go back in time. Rav Menachem Mendel was born in 1902 in a small town, which I didn't name here. I believe it's a small town in Russia, or generally Russia, I'm not really sure. I forgot the name, something with a V. Either way, of course, I don't have the most basic information here. I was too busy looking at all the other exciting stuff. So he was born in 1902. He was the son of Reb Leib Yitzchak and Chana. Also, I believe, also Schneerson. They were cousins of the Schneersons. And they named him Reb Menachem Mendel because they were already part of Chabad, Schneerson. They named him Reb Menachem Mendel after the Tzemach Tzedek. Coincidentally, who was the Tzemach Tzedek named for? Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson, the original, was named for Rav Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk, who the Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi had originally gone to the Vilna Gaon with. Right, so Menachem Mendel, people think of it as a Chabad name. Originally, it wasn't a Chabad name. It was just a Hasidic name. Either way, so he's named Rav Menachem Mendel after the Tzemach Tzedek. There's some interesting history here. Basically, Rav Menachem Mendel was a child prodigy, as you can imagine. He had an unbelievable memory. He had a private tutor. The tutor, when he was 11 years old, told him, "I have nothing else to teach this boy." We've seen that story before for other gedolim. So he goes to learn from by his father, Reb Leib Yitzchak, who teaches him, and they start learning Kabbalah at an early age. They say by the time he was 15, 16 years old, he knew all of Shas and Rashi Tosfos, the whole thing. And then it's unclear. Some of it gets a little murky, where he goes and who he learns from. We know that and I'm sure there are people that say there is a more concrete, you know, discussion, but this is still in Europe where we don't have as good documentation in the early 1900s. In these smaller towns. So in 1923, he meets Chaimushka. They were cousins, or distant cousins, not first cousins, distant cousins. Not that first cousin would be off limits in Chabad either, but they were distant cousins. And they meet in 1923, but they don't get married. They actually don't get married until 1928. And this is somewhat of a mystery. What exactly happened? Why didn't they get married right away? At the time, the Lubavitch Rebbe, who wasn't yet the Lubavitch Rebbe, was already, you know, 21 years old. That's plenty late enough for a Hasidic rabbi to get married. But for some reason, didn't. And he was a very cultured, you know, kid. He was already at this time going to university in in Berlin, I believe. And this university in Berlin, it changed names here and there. I can't remember all the names, but Hambud or something like that. But this university in Berlin was a very popular university for big gedolim. Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, the Rav, was in this university at the same time. There are legends. Maybe they knew each other. Maybe they saw each other. Maybe they brought that relationship over to America later on. Unclear if that actually happened. There was Rav Yitzhak Huttner, who we might have talked about before, of Brooklyn. There was Nechama Leibowitz. People know Nechama Leibowitz. Did we talk about Nechama Leibowitz yet? I don't think we have. We did Sarishner, but we'll talk about her eventually, Mirtz Hashem. So they're all at this place in Berlin, right? It used to be a thing to go to college, you know? Interestingly enough, later in his life, the Lubavitcher Rebbe tells people not to go to college. And his father-in-law, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, also tells people not to go to college. But Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak was the one who paid for his college. So at the time, they were okay with it. I don't know if it's because Berlin was different or because things changed. But either way, at the time, the Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, the Friedeker, and the Rebbe himself were okay with going to university. He never actually gets a degree in Berlin, which is interesting. He actually ultimately gets a degree in Paris when he gets there later. And that takes him a while also because apparently he missed a lot of classes because of Shabbos, whatever. It took him longer than usual to get his degree. He ultimately gets a degree in, anyone know?
Engineering,
that's right. He gets a degree in engineering, which he puts to use soon when he gets to America. He gets married in 1928 in Warsaw, interestingly enough. None of them lived in Warsaw, at least not for a substantial amount of time. I think Rav Yosef Yitzchak, when he was getting out of the war, stopped off in Warsaw for a little bit. But either way, they got married in Warsaw. Legend has it because it was supposed to be a big prominent wedding. So if you had the wedding in Lubavitch or in Riga where they were living, so then not that many Hasidic Rebbes would be there. But you have it in Warsaw. It would gain more attention for the movement, gain more attention for the Rebbe. And who wasn't necessarily going to be the Rebbe. I mean, he's going to Berlin University or whatever. He's not necessarily, you know, being primed to become the Rebbe. Unclear what the plan was. This is part of the controversy of Chabad going forward. There didn't seem to be a plan in place. And the Rebbe didn't, at least from his trajectory, didn't seem to be the one to take over from his father-in-law. Either way, they have the wedding in Warsaw. They expected a lot of big Rabbanim to come. Some did. But not that many did, meaning in Warsaw, you would expect the Ger Rebbe to show up. He didn't come. You would expect other Rabbanim to come. They didn't come either. So I've read different things. There were big Rabbanim there. There weren't the big Rabbanim there. Different things. But we do have invitations to that wedding, which is interesting. The place cards of the weddings, somehow we have these things. Chabad, of all institutions, is the best of recovering these types of things. But either way, so... he goes to study in Berlin. He went to learn by, in the meantime, sometime during this process, it's unclear who from whom the Rebbe got smicha, which is an interesting question. Not that it has big nafkaminas, but the two main possibilities are that he got smicha from the Sri Deish, Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. I forgot where his yeshiva was. Say it here. I'm not sure, but he was a Talmud of Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, which was a big deal, because again the Lubavitcher Rebbe was a worldly person. So where does he get that outlook from? It could be he got it from the Sri Deish. Well, we know he was by the Sri Deish. Why did he got smicha from there? We don't know, but we know he was by the Sri Deish and learned from the Sri Deish. So it's possible that he got that hashkafas achayim of being worldly and of knowledge, being knowledgeable. He got that from the Sri Deish, which comes from Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. That's possible too. The other possibility is that he got it from the Rugachever. We know Rabbi Yosef Rosen, the Rugachever, was brilliant. He had one of those photographic memories, and he was just, a lot of legends about the Rugachever's mind. He was, I believe, more Hasidic. I think it was even Chabad. And he was sort of like a co-rabbi in Dvinsk with Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk. I think I quoted last week. For something, the Meshech Chachma. So either way, or Sameach. So he might have gotten smicha from either the Sri Deish or from the Rugachever. Both Gedolim of Europe, right? Neither, you're not a big nafkamina, which one was really it. He learned by both of them. He had relationships with both of them. Either way, he marries Chaim Mushka in 1928 in Warsaw. And by the way, his parents couldn't even come. His parents couldn't be there at the actual wedding. They weren't able to get out of... you want to take that? They weren't able to get out with a permit in Riga, from Riga. So they weren't able to go to the wedding. That might have also been part of why they delayed the wedding. There are different legends about why they might have delayed the wedding. Either way, so Chaim Mushka was also more worldly. They say that Chaim Mushka had been read a shidduch when she was younger, and she declined because she didn't want to go through a shidduch system. She met the Rebbe more organically. You still have to close it. You have to hang it up. She met the Rebbe more organically at Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak's house, right? Because they were cousins, or distant cousins, whatever. So ultimately, they settled down in Paris. The reason they go to Paris, they don't stay where they were, is because 1933. We know 1933, unfortunately. The Nazis, Yimach Shemam Zichram, come to power. They get out of wherever they were, in Riga. Mm-hmm. And then they settle down in Paris. He goes to attend the university, as we said before, misses classes, ultimately gets a degree in 1938. Took him 5 years to graduate. So for anyone with kids, taking a while. Lubavitch Rebbe took a while too. Either way, so they go to Paris, and while he's there in Paris, in the university, he actually is enlisted by his father-in-law, right, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, who's now, now he's sort of familially tied into the movement, which is not necessarily a guarantee that he has any administrative power or any administrative position, but Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak enlists him to do some research into the manuscripts of the Chabad Rabbanim from previous generations. So he's already working on the side for Chabad internationally. Again, there's no indication that he was hoping to be the next Rebbe. And we have legends about how Rav Menachem Mendel would fast while he was in Paris, because Paris is not exactly the most Hasidish city, right? And so he took it upon himself to do a little extra, right? To fast at least through midday, at least till Mincha. His father-in-law told him to stop it because it wasn't healthy. But ultimately, he was doing these types of things where he was trying to maintain his Yiddishkeit in what you would probably see as a secular island. Either way, so 1940, the Friedeker Rebbe really escapes, I think it's by a few days. He escapes out of Poland to America. This is in 1940, maybe 1941, I remember. And he gets to New York. He's brought over by I don't know if it was the Hasidim or family, I don't remember. But he settles in 770 Eastern Parkway, right? People familiar with that building? We've heard it before. He actually goes from place to place. He goes to Warsaw, Berlin, Kovna, Riga, Sweden, and then ultimately ends up in New York City. This is only the Friedeker Rebbe, the current Rebbe at the time in 1940, the father-in-law. So he escapes Poland after going from place to place. And he was already not so well off. He was already struggling. He had multiple sclerosis. He also had a stroke. So he's not so healthy even already when he gets to New York City. Nonetheless, he powers through it for the sake of American Jewry, which at the time was, there were institutions. You had higher institutions of learning, but there was a lot of work to be done, right? Especially New York City, a lot of secular pockets of Jewry there. So he goes to work and really sets up Chabad. So his son-in-law that we mentioned before, we said before, Chana, his daughter, is married to Rav Shmaryahu Gerari. And Rav Shmaryahu Gerari, through other channels, gets a visa for Rav Menachem Mendel and his sister-in-law, Chaya Mushka. And they're able to come to the U.S. about a year later. So Menachem Mendel takes a job, not in Chabad, although it's unclear what the timing is. Maybe he did a little bit for Chabad first, but he ultimately takes a job in the Navy Yard. for helping out the war efforts. He becomes a somewhat of an electrical engineer for the different Navy boats, making sure that everything is properly engineered on the ships so that they can function well at war. It's kind of interesting. There are stories later on where people would come to the Rebbe and talk engineering with him, which is just a funny thing to imagine. But either way, so he takes this engineering job, and then he becomes more and more active in Chabad at 770, and he becomes a U.S. citizen in 1946, which is a big deal. Something to know about both his father-in-law and the Rebbe himself, they rarely left Crown Heights. They very rarely left Crown Heights. I believe they never left New York. The only time I think the Rebbe ever left Crown Heights was later in life to go to the hospital, but also to go to his father-in-law's kever when he dies in 1951. So he used to go all the time to visit what we now know as the Ohel, but was already the Ohel back then, for Rav Yosef Yitzchak. That's in Queens, the Montefiore Cemetery. So he becomes U.S. citizen. Why is that important? Because they didn't even go to the courthouse for it. The courthouse came to them. This is kind of interesting. And we have videos of this in 1946. I think it was 1946, unless I get my dates right. It's one of those years, the end of the 40s, where some Jewish judges and some other clerks at the courthouse actually bring the whole process to 770. I think it was 770. And you have this on film. They filmed it as if it was like this big, you know, to-do to watch the Rebbe, really, at that time, the Friedrich Rebbe, to become a U.S. citizen, which is a big deal. You know, this is sort of like a monumentous occasion where we're no longer in Europe, right? So it was a big deal at that time, become a U.S. citizen. So towards the end of Rav Yosef Yitzchak's life, he's in America, right? So the last 10 years he's in America, and he's talking a lot about tshuva. He's talking a lot about Mashiach coming because of the Holocaust, and he's telling people that this is sort of the ikvus of the Mashiach, if you will. We're right at the end of Jewish history. This is the time for Mashiach. And people start to believe, now this is going to sound familiar, but I'm not making a mistake. We're talking about the sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, the Friedrich Rebbe. They think that he's Mashiach. So people in America start to think that he's Mashiach, the sixth Rebbe, including Rav Menachem Mendel, his son-in-law. Rav Menachem Mendel had the highest reverence for his father-in-law. He would say for years that, and that's why he would always visit him at the kever. The only place he ever went outside of Crown Heights was to visit the kever of his father-in-law. He had very, very strong reverence to his father-in-law. His father-in-law, Rav Yosef Yitzchak, dies in 1950. January, Yud Shvat is the art site, still obviously a day of observance for Chabad. Unfortunately, he doesn't leave over a will, and he also doesn't leave over any sons. So he's got two sons-in-law, the Rebbe, Rav Menachem Mendel, and the Rashad, Rav Shmariyahu Gurari, who we just talked about, helped get Rav Menachem Mendel over to America. So, and there was another one, if you remember, he died in Treblinka. So, what happens now is that the Chabad movement has to decide. And this is really a turning point for Chabad generally. Chabad, like other Hasidic sects, was very, you know, affected by the Holocaust. Many of them also, you know, were dispersed either to assimilation in Russia or to decimation in the camps. And now they're rebuilding themselves in America. Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak has already started the rebuilding process. And now the question is, who's going to take over and continue this building, continue the rejuvenation of the movement? Everyone thought, or at least the family thought, that Rav Shmariyahu was going to be the next Rebbe. Because, after all, Rav Shmariyahu was the older one. He was the one that was more involved with Chabad. He was the one who had taken care of Menachem Mendel himself. And he was the one that basically was sort of like the assistant of the Friedrich Rebbe. So his wife, Chana, thinks he's going to become the Rebbe. But more importantly, his mother, the Rebbetzin of Chabad, Rebbe Nechama Dina, I think was her name. She thought that her son, Rebbe Shmaryahu, was going to be the next Rebbe. Now this is important because when the leadership of Chabad, whoever that is, I don't exactly know who makes these decisions and how they make them, when they point to Rav Menachem Mendel to become the leader, he first rejects it and says, this is never what I wanted. It's not, I can't take over from my father-in-law. It's not me. But ultimately, everybody wants him to be the Rebbe. For whatever reason, he had special qualities about him. You can understand why. So when it ultimately comes about a year after the Arset, to the day Rav Menachem Mendel is taking over Chabad, 1951, January 1951, he takes over Chabad in this big event with this big sicha, which was a sort of a commentary on the last sicha, which was supposed to be but never was given by his father-in-law, called Basi Lagani. I think it's a play on the words in Shir Shirim. But he gives this whole sicha, and it's a whole thing, and hundreds of rabbis come to hear the next Rebbe take over Chabad. This is sort of like, I don't know if I should say Lahavdil or not, State of the Union address, the swearing in, basically. So you expect everybody to rally around him. But his mother-in-law, Rebbe Tzin Nechama Dina, was still upset that Rebbe Shmaryahu wasn't the Rebbe. This is the stuff Chabad doesn't want you to hear about. And, I don't want to, it's a very important part of Chabad. It's a very important part of Chabad history. But she doesn't like it. Why? What happens because she doesn't like it? A couple different things happen. Number one, and this is fascinating, people know what Chabad looks like nowadays, right? You know what people of Chabad, that follow Chabad, look like? They have a very specific look. What's sort of a unique thing about Chabad?
Fedora.
That fedora, right? The fedora is a very specific fedora. It's not like yeshivish fedoras, right? It's a little pointier. Maybe the brim is smaller. It has that bend in the middle. It looks a little different. You could pick it out of a car. You can't necessarily, know exactly. Why do they have that hat? All Hasidic rabbis had a shtreimel. So where's the shtreimel? Apparently, that's true. Thank you, Francie. I don't know. I guess she's with Jason here. The Rebbe did visit the Chabad camp a couple times, besides going to his father's kever, father-in-law's kever, Shkaya Francie, in the summers. But the legend is that Rebbe Nechama Dina had the shtreimel of her husband, and she didn't want to give it to the Lubavitch Rebbe. The Lubavitch Rebbe, because she thought Rav Shmaryahu should have been the Rebbe. So Rav Menachem Mendel says, okay, I'll just keep my hat. And that's the fedora story. That's why Chabad wears that hat. Because the shtreimel was never given over to the Lubavitch Rebbe. Which is, obviously there are a lot of other things that factor into why Chabad is different from all other Hasidic sects. But on the outside, that's where they get their, that's where they get their look from. It's very interesting, so maybe trivial, maybe not trivial, depending how you look at it, point of what a differentiating trivial point of Chabad, which comes from this controversy. Another famous controversy that comes out of Chabad, which they talk about a little bit more, but they're still not proud of, something that happens with Rav Shmaryahu's son. Anyone know Rav Shmaryahu's son's name? It's not a very Hasidish name. His name was Barry.
Uh-huh.
His actual name was Rav Dov Ber, named after the Hasidic Rebbe, Rav Dov Ber. So the Mittler Rebbe, I think it was the Mittler Rebbe Dov Ber. Either way. So one day, and this is later on, but it's a remnant of this machlokas. Barry is caught on video taking some of the Friedeker Rebbe's svarim out of 770. This became a very big to-do. Barry claimed that he was the rightful heir of the Svarim, and because he was from the older family. And he actually goes and sells it for hundreds of thousands of dollars. He sells the Svarim of the Rebbe on, I don't know who exactly bought them and what they thought they could get away with. All right, this is like, how do you ever sell like art on the black market? Like, you're going to be figured out at some point. But either way, so Rav Shmaryahu's son, Barry, steals these books, or takes his books, whatever, it depends who you ask. And then as that goes to federal court, And the Anshei Chabad, there's like a Agudas Chasidei Chabad or something. The name of Chabad, the official name of Chabad, is representing, you know, the 770 position, which is that these books belong to the movement. They happen to be used by Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, but they belong to the movement, right? This is not any personal person's books. And they ultimately win the case. And this is this becomes a holiday for Chabad, Didan Netzach, that we won the you know, whatever you want to call it, the dispute. We got to keep the books. And this is, I think this is in the 80s already, 85 maybe, and it's from then on it's a holiday in Chabad. What is it, Yud Teves or something like that? Let me look this up. I have it somewhere here.
Is this information that Chabad doesn't want anyone to know?
This part is a little more celebrated. So this part, Chabad, is okay with you knowing. They celebrate the 5th of Teves. I think it's the 5th of Teves I have here in my notes. They celebrate this as a holiday. And Svarim stores, definitely Chabad Svarim stores, but even non-Chabad Svarim stores always have sales on the 5th of Teves because of this day. Because it was the day that Chabad reclaimed their Svarim. Which is sort of like a sort of a novel, very Chabad type of thing to do, to make a holiday for that type of thing.
Why didn't you go to the Sanhedrin?
So I don't know if they're, you're making me like a Beis Din.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's an interesting question. Maybe they did and they couldn't resolve it and they went to federal court. I don't know. It's a good question. I think I've talked about that with somebody once, a Chabadnik once, a long time ago.
I learned this Chabad. I never heard any of these things.
Oh yeah, this is one of those background stories. You'll know that there's a holiday on Hey Tavis if you're Chabad. You might not know the backstory of it, but this definitely happened. It was written up in the New York Times. Like, you can find articles about it in secular culture about this whole debate. It goes to interesting sort of nuanced, you know, positions of law. Like, how do you define inheritance? How do you define, you know, possession? Stuff like that. It's very interesting, just on in a jurisprudence level. So it got a lot of coverage. Either way, let's go back to 1951. Rav Menachem Mendel, so that was the reason I brought it up, is because that is a carryover from that machlokes about who's the rightful owner of Chabad. Right? That tension stays for the rest of Nechama Dina's life. I think she dies in, actually, I don't know when she died. The Rebbe's mother died in 67, I think. I don't know when the Rebbe's Nechama Dina died, but what's interesting is, I believe she's buried in a different place. I think she's buried in New Jersey, along with her daughter, Chana, and Rav Shmaryahu Gurari, who was the other candidate to become the Rebbe, basically says, I'm with the Rebbe. I'm with Rav Menachem Mendel. And he continues to work for Chabad, and he has no hard feelings. It's the women that have the hard feelings. And he's buried in by the Ohel. Right, he's buried. You know, the legacy is that he stays with, you know, Chabad's, you know, main plot in Queens, whereas the women, the other ones, are somewhere in New Jersey. I think that's where they're in, New Jersey somewhere. Either way, so he has this. So he has this whole sicha in 1951, the continuation of Chabad, the continuation of his father-in-law's sikh from the year before. He talks about the seven stages of the world until Mashiach, which already gives, you know, a little bit of a foreboding to what's going to happen later, where this is the last stage. To the extent that when it's towards the end of Menachem Mendel's life, he's in his 90s, and they're asking him, like, well, not really in his 90s at that point, because for other reasons we'll see, but they ask him, like, what's the plan? You don't have any children. So who's going to be the next Rebbe? And he would respond to them, it doesn't matter, Mashiach's going to come, we're not going to have to worry about it. That's what he would say. And that's, he already sort of announces this in his opening sicha to Chabad, that there are seven stages, and after the seventh one is Mashiach, right? That's the Lamala Menatev. So either way, so that was his message was that we're going to bring the Shekhinah down to the world, which is a general Hasidic message, but with a twist, as opposed to other Hasidim who bring Hashem into the world through their own personal activities. Chabad was going to be focused on bringing Hashem into the world by influencing others in other places. And this is where the general the general hashkafa of Chabad, of going out into Yehupitzville and finding the Jews and bringing Yiddishkeit to them, this is where it comes from. And he focuses, and the Rebbe was very particular to say that every mitzvah of every Jew counts. Right? This is not like we have to turn them into Bali Tshuva and only then do their mitzvahs count. Any mitzvah that any Jew does is a precious mitzvah. That's bringing the Shekhinah down to the world in that small part. And this is why he focuses on two specific mitzvahs. Anyone want to guess? Tefillin and candle lighting. These are the big mitzvahs that the Rebbe, right? And the New York Times, right? This is the famous shtick about the New York Times, that they would always put, is it still on there? The candle lighting times for Shabbos are on the New York Times on Friday. At least they used to be. And in the year 2000, I believe they made like a special edition. This is like a famous thing. The special edition New York Times front page, where it was like, what's it going to look like? What's the New York Times going to look like in 100 years from now? And they still put the candle lighting times on there. Because they knew that, you know, things might change in the world, but the Jews are going to still light Shabbos candles. But either that initiative of lighting Shabbos candles was, I believe, that initiative of putting the times on was because of Chabad. This is called Neshek, right? Nero Shabbos Kodesh. Neshek also means like a weapon, right? Sort of like hearkening back to Yaakov Avinu, whatever. So this is where that whole tradition of Chabad comes from, of giving out Shabbos candles, even to single girls doing Shabbos candles, and even telling people on the street. You know, I just seen someone from our show was recently in Eretz Yisrael, and he was walking through the shuk, and someone stopped him and asked him to put on tefillin yet. Mm-hmm. So it's like, I'm wearing a yarmulke, you know, all these Israeli Jews around not wearing yarmulkes, you chose me to stop me. So anyways, it's always a funny thing. But they don't have any shame, right? If there's one thing Chabad, Shluchim have to figure out early on, is how to do things without shame. They'll ask anybody if they haven't put on tefillin yet. And in the old city, they do Kiddush. I don't know if you've seen this. They ask people if they've heard Kiddush yet on Shabbos morning. Either way. After 67, he sends Shluchim to Eretz Yisrael. Actually, let's skip to some stories now. Rav Menachem Mendel, you know, took over for his father. We know in this light, he loved all Jews. He tried to help all Jews. And for about, you know, 25 years or so, he would be willing to meet with anybody, right? And this is called the Yechidus. Yechidus is like a special private, you know, meeting with the Rebbe. You probably know people that have had Yechidus meetings with the Rebbe. Not sure exactly sure how to say it in different contexts, but different syntax. But either way, he would meet with different Rabbanim and even different politicians, Israeli politicians, secular politicians. Ronald Reagan came once. So there's a famous story about a woman named Shirley Chisholm. Mm-hmm. You know this story?
She's a congresswoman.
She was the first African-American congresswoman in Brooklyn, 12th District of Brooklyn, which is basically two populations, Jews and blacks.
And it was her district.
That was her district.
Yeah.
And they put her, and she thought it was an insult, they put her on the Agricultural Committee in Congress. And she was very, very, very offended by this because there's no farming in Brooklyn. Anyone ever been there? Even today, still no farming in Brooklyn, unless you're doing like hydroponics on a roof or something. But so she's like, "Oh, they gave it to me. It's racist because whatever." So she's complaining about this. I think the Rebbe might have called her in. I heard different versions of it, that she went to the Rebbe or the Rebbe called her in, I think they had a relationship from before for a communal thing. I don't remember. But either way, so she talks to the Rebbe and she's bemoaning this and feel very offended by it. And the Rebbe says, "You don't understand the beautiful gift that you have. There must be something you can do with this gift that Hashem has given you to help people out." And it's unclear if he said this to her or if she figured this out along with Bob Dole, who at the time was a senator in Kansas. Not yet the Bob Dole, as we know of in the presidential election, but and she links up with him in one way or another. Either the Rebbe proposed it or they figured it out independently that there is a surplus. The farmers were having a surplus on produce, and they could only sell a certain portion of their crop, and the rest of it was just being wasted. And instead of wasting it, she set up a program along with Bob Dole, to take that crop in a federal program that the government would pay for it, and they would give it to malnourished children and women in pregnancy, because there were all these medical conditions for these impoverished families that weren't getting the proper nutrition. And this ultimately becomes what people know, I don't know if people know it here as, but it's called WIC. People know of WIC?
Yeah.
Do they have that here, or is that just New York City?
No, they have it here.
They have
it here? Women, infants, and children.
Yeah, women, infants, and children. So we actually got WIC when we lived in New York City, but we never actually used it, whatever. It was a whole long process. But it still exists today. And at Chisholm's retirement party, she credited the Lubavitcher Rebbe for that program. That's what she said at her retirement party. She says, you know, all these children can eat because of a great rabbi's vision. That's what she said, something like that. I believe that story is in this book, which came out a few years ago, from Telushkin, a beautiful, wonderful book. I haven't read it. Ricky read it, and she told me some of the stories. But it's a great reference for some of these legends. That one's in there, I believe. So that was late in 1968. Before that, maybe earlier, right before that, another personal meeting of Jonathan Sacks, yeah. Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, had taken a trip to America after, I guess he was a sophomore at Oxford, and he went to meet with some of the big Rebbeim. He spoke to Rav Soloveitchik, and Rav Sacks says that Rav Soloveitchik told me, that I have to think deeper, and he went to Rav Menachem Mendel, and he said to him, you're schmoozing, whatever. And Rabbi Nachum Mendel asked him, the Rebbe asked him, well, what's it like on campus at Oxford? You know, how are the Jews doing? And he says, not well. He said, about 90% of them aren't Jewish at all. They're assimilating. And the Rebbe turned to him and he said, okay, what are you going to do about it? And Rabbi's like, what do you mean, what am I going to do about it? I'm a sophomore at Oxford. What do you want me to do about it? But he said that was one of the callings that he saw the Rebbe was sort of tasking him with taking care of English Jewry. So that was probably in the mid to late 1960s for Rabbi Sacks. There was an interesting story I saw on YouTube. Another story that I saw. There was a woman who was from Austria, and she was making relatively frequent trips to New York, and she had seen the Rebbe, and the Rebbe at one time said, you have to do something for me. When you get back to Austria, anyone know the story? Find Viktor Frankl and tell him to keep doing his job. Don't give up on his message. Viktor Frankl was big on, we're getting at that in a second. He's famous for logotherapy, I think it was called. Right, the idea that people are driven by purpose, and this is what he saw in the camps, etc. There's a will, any why can Nietzsche's phrase, any why can justify any what or something like that, can justify any how, I think the phrase is. Either way, so this woman gets back to Austria, goes to Vienna, finds Viktor Frankl, and tells him this message, and he breaks down crying. He showed her on his dining room table he had tickets to leave Vienna and go start a new career somewhere. And he credits later on in history, I heard this from a Chabad Shliach who had spoken to Viktor Frankl when he was in his 90s and said to him, is this story true? And he says, I owe my career to the Lubavitcher Rebbe for that message. It was just the perfect timing. He knew exactly, another story I heard from Rav Tzvi Hirsch Weinreb. People know Rav Tzvi Weinreb from the OU. Big rabbi in Baltimore, is the president of the OU for a while. And so Rav Tzvi Hirsch Weinreb he tells the story a lot now because of, I forgot who he was talking to. He always talked to Rav Sacks, and Rav Sacks told him, you have to tell the story more. So one time when he was in his early 30s in Silver Spring, so Rav Weinreb called up the Rebbe's office, and the secretary answers the phone and says, what do you want? He said, I want to speak to the Rebbe. I'm making a lot of decisions. I don't know what to do with my life. Should I become a psychologist? Should I become a Rebbe? Whatever. And the Rebbe is in the room and hears what's going on and tells the secretary, there's a guy in Maryland that can help you. His name is Weinreb. So Rav Weinreb was on the phone. He hadn't yet said his name. So he says back to the secretary, the secretary says to him, I heard this from Rav Weinreb. The secretary says to him, did you hear what the Rebbe said? And wanting clarification to know that what he heard was really true. So he asked him, no, I didn't hear that. Could you say it again? So he says again, there's a guy that you should go speak to in Maryland called Weinreb. So he says, Weinreb, I'm Weinreb. So the Rebbe heard him say, I'm Weinreb. And the Rebbe says, sometimes when you come to a decision, all you have to do is talk to yourself. So Rav Weinreb took that to heart and he discussed it with himself. Should I do this? Should I do that? And he said that's how he came to the decision to become a Rav. He was a Rav for many years in Baltimore and then went on to become sort of like the president of the OU for many years also. So these stories are dozens, hundreds of them that people tell about their meetings with the Rebbe. You can find them on YouTube. Chabad does a great job publicizing all of them. So you can find a lot of these features. They're unbelievable. A lot of them bring you to tears. Let me just see here any other specific stories that I have. I love that Rav Weinreb story. Another thing that is sort of in line with the Rebbe, taking care of other Jews, he was very invested, as many Rabbanim were, in helping Soviet Jewry. And obviously with Chabad's mission of going out and finding Jews and helping Jews, this was also part of their mission. But the Rebbe was very opposed, apparently. I saw in the book too, I haven't read the chapter, but he was very opposed to public displays on behalf of Soviet Jewry. Apparently that would worsen the situation, it would cause more of a ruckus and wouldn't be helpful. He was always in favor of doing it, very subtly and in private, helping the Jews that way. In 1977, the Rebbe, I believe, had a heart attack. The story goes, he had a heart attack in 770, and all the doctors that converged on the scene came and basically said, you have to go to hospital. This is not, you can't just sit here. And the Rebbe didn't want to go. Why did the Rebbe not want to go? I don't know. Maybe it's because he didn't want to leave his talmidim. Maybe because he didn't think whatever. So one of the Gabayim, Chabad Gabayim, came out of, was walking in the hall of 770 when it was going on. And Chaya Mushka, the Rebbetzin, was walking down and saw him and said, hey, what's going on? And they said that the doctors, explained the situation, the doctors have to sedate him and bring him to the hospital. So she said something along the lines of, and I heard this from the Gabbai, it's on YouTube, you can find it. The Gabbai said something that she said, something along the lines of, for all the time I've ever known Rav Menachem Mendel, I've never seen him not in control of himself. You're absolutely not allowed to do it. There are so many doctors in this city and around the country. Just bring them here instead of bringing him to the hospital. Now, that's very helpful for the Rebbe. There might have been something behind it in terms of the Rebbe's mystique and his grand nature. What would it be like if the Rebbe is in a hospital in a gown like everybody else? There might have been something like that. And this might have also just increased the mystique that the Rebbe is, above, other people. He actually recovers from this. They didn't think he would, but he recovers 100% from it, basically 100% from this. This is, and after this time, he starts other campaigns, the Hanukkah stuff, right? The Hanukkah thing, menorah, was also started by the Rebbe. Can't remember other campaigns. He had other ones too. Maybe Brachos campaigns or stuff like that. In the mid-80s, he starts what people might have seen on video, his dollars. Yeah. Right, what does he call them? He's like a his Sunday morning tzedakah meetings where people would come and he just give out dollars to people. I think it was based on his father-in-law said that when two people are greeting each other, they should benefit a third or something like that. So this was his way of saying go do the tzedakah, and you can find videos, tons of these different diplomats coming, and he has these quick conversations with them. And then they go, he gives them a bunch of dollars for this thing, for that thing, whatever. So that's in the 80s. Ultimately, he's giving more and more of these fiery drushes about Mashiach. He's getting older, right? He's 80, he's born in 1902. So basically, whatever year I say, that's how old he is. Yeah. So, this is the 80s. And in, I believe, 1992, they allowed him... Again, because of his sort of you know, above the fray personality. Chabad allowed him to go to the kever of his father-in-law like he would often do by himself. You know, sort of just, he spotted his time, just time to be alone. Apparently on that trip in 1992, he had a stroke and nobody knew about it because he was by himself. And it was apparently, they only found him about 4 hours later. And obviously if they would have gotten him earlier, so there would, the effects would have been worse, you know, not as bad. But he's also 90 years old at the time. So, you know, not unclear exactly, you know, what the ramifications would have been otherwise. Anyway, but 1990, so this, and this left him basically unable to speak. He could barely move his arms and things like that. While you would think that during this time, people would sort of get the message that maybe he's not ushering in Mashiach because now he's basically incapacitated, this actually just bolstered some people in Chabad. And there were apparently, I heard this from Rav Tovah Singer, that there were people who were now finding different ma'amarim or different, you know, different ma'amari chazal, different psukim that implied that Mashiach is going to get sick and then he's going to reveal himself as Mashiach. And this only bolstered that narrative because people thought he was Mashiach, now he's gotten sick and this is it, he's going to come out to be Mashiach. This time period where he was sort of like untouchable and unreachable was actually, you know, a furthering of the Mashiach ideology. Ultimately, as we know, he passes away in 1994, June 12th, on the 3rd of Tammuz, which is last week, roughly. And he's buried next to his father-in-law in Queens, now called the Ohel. Many go there to put notes down. They write notes, thousands upon thousands, tens of thousands of notes there. People, you can fax in a note, you can email in a note. They'll put it by the kever. I'm not really sure what they do with some. They can't possibly...
and then people
die. Yeah. No, well, I don't know if you can still fax, but I'm just saying that
email it.
I'm just saying, I don't know where the papers are. They can't possibly fit all those papers. It's been, you know, 30 years. So I don't know exactly if there's like a, I know at the Kotel, all those notes, they clean them out, right? But I don't know what they do at the Rebbe's Kever. I don't know if they do that also. If they did, I'm sure they don't want to show anybody that. But part of this is an interesting thing also. Part of the legend of him sort of, you know, hinting to Mashiach is he would say things like, Mashiach is coming now, mamish. Now, mamish in Hebrew means like, really, you know, actually. But what else is mamish? Anyone know? Menachem Mendel Schneerson. So people think he was being coy and hinting to the fact that he's Mashiach. So this, and for people who want him to be Mashiach, so then, you know, they're going to latch on to anything. So ultimately, even after he passes, as you know, there's still a segment of Chabad, you know, hopefully it's dwindling, that still believe he's Mashiach. You don't have to, you know, question me too long for me to tell you that I do not believe he's Mashiach. It's possible there are Gemaras that say that every generation has someone who can be Mashiach, that maybe he was in that generation a possible Mashiach. You don't know, you can't possibly know these things. There are halachic issues and heavy possible prohibitions to believe that the Rebbe is Mashiach nowadays. We're not going to go through all of them now, but suffice it to say that I think that this movement is dying out and it doesn't really, you know, it doesn't really speak to a modern the crowd that we have nowadays, the intuitions of this generation, whatever.
Is there still like a big movement on Israel? People like
there are people all over the world that still believe that. Mm-hmm. But they're a minority. I believe they're a significant minority, but they're a vocal minority. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that put on all the big programs. Then if you go to 770, they've basically taken it over, and there's some weird things that they do there that probably are halakhically, you know, problematic, but not for me to go into now. But ultimately, the legacy of the Rebbe should be much more about the unbelievable things he did for individuals, for the people of America, for the movement, and for Jewry, you know, all over the world. You read his sichas; they're beautiful sichas. They're somewhat lengthy. I gave you one here. I don't think we have time to go through it, but they're beautiful. And you know, the Hebrew is beautiful. He has a sefer on Rashi, or his sichas on Rashi. And he just he weaves things together. I should really quote him more. I don't have enough of his svarim. I quoted him in my Shabbat Shuvah drasha this past year about Yom Kippur and what that represents, whatever. Actually connected to today's daf, but not for now. A couple other things that maybe you don't know about. Israel. Where did the Rebbe stand on Israel? The Rebbe was a fan of the Jewish state of Israel. But he wasn't the fan of a state for Jews in Israel. This is the distinction that he was very very specific about. He's okay with a state which is run halachically, meaning that the state is Jewish. Mm-hmm. It's a Jewish state, then I'm behind it. But if it's a state just for Jews to live in, then, you know, and the government's secular and it's not dictated by halacha, so then he was never a fan of the Israeli government. He would meet with the Israeli diplomats. He would be supportive of the causes of Jewry in Eretz Yisrael. You know, you can see videos of him meeting with Ben Gurion and things like that. But he was never Zionistic in the classical way that we think of Zionism, because that was a secular movement. It wasn't dictated by halacha, and therefore he wasn't a big proponent of it. Girls' education. He was a big proponent of girls' education. Torah education for girls. You know, I stumbled upon a strange YouTube video because whatever, you know, the algorithm on YouTube, based on what you watch, just gives you random Jewish things if you're someone like me. So they sent, you know, there was like a girls' competition, a Torah competition, like little girls, like elementary school or middle school girls talking over the Torah of the Rebbe. I would have preferred that they were learning Torah or Mishnah. I don't know why they have to be learning the sichos of the Rebbe when they're 11 years old. But either way, just the girls' education is a big focus of his. He, you know, a very big proponent of setting up girls' schools and things like that. I just wanted to say this one interesting shtickle here that he has about making Aliyah in this book. Let's see if I can find it here. Hold on. I just thought this was a very poignant quote. I completely and unequivocally opposed. Well, this is about Israel generally. He was also opposed to surrendering any parts of Eretz Yisrael. Right, he didn't want to give any part of it, not because necessarily, you know, Eretz Yisrael and the Kedusha, but also because Pikuach Nefesh. He thought that it was, you know, this was one of his controversial statements, that it was Pikuach Nefesh threatening the lives of Jews to give up any part of Eretz Yisrael. The lighting of the menorah in the public square is also pretty controversial. Where's this piece about Aliyah? I'm trying to find it here. Sorry, I don't know if it's here or not. Either way, he says something along... Oh, here. I personally support Aliyah, and I've instructed certain families to make Aliyah, but we mustn't just eliminate a Jewish community. So meaning like this, I think what he means is like this, that Aliyah is a wonderful thing for people to do, but to make Aliyah and thereby ruin all the other Jews who are left behind without that structure that they need, or I would say, conversely, to make Aliyah and then not have the structure that an individual is used to, that an individual needs for their own Jewishness and their own Avodas Hashem, so then it's not that you have to run the calculus. Even the Gemara talks about situations where it's not justified to make Aliyah, if for Parnassa, if for your marriage, or if for your learning and presumably your Kiyum Torah and Mitzvos. So there are different situations that would or would not justify Aliyah. So fascinating character, brilliant mind. You know, not just in Torah, but in sciences, as we saw from his early childhood, he was already interested in that. He spoke like 9 languages, or he was familiar with 9 languages. And you can see some of that. He spoke, obviously, English, Yiddish, Hebrew. And he's familiar with French and Russian because of everywhere he lived. So just an unbelievable character. I wish we could talk more about him. I wish I could finally read this book. This is like 600 pages. It's a good book. I've heard good things about it. And there are things in here that other people haven't really, you know, Tolushkin did a great job researching and things like that. So I recommend the book, even though I haven't read it.
So do I.
Oh, you've read it?
Yes. Okay. I read it when it came out.
Yeah.
It's a quick reading.
Is it a quick read? I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm a slow reader, so that probably evens out. But either way, fascinating. Obviously, I don't have to convince you that he's a fascinating character, but this is a little bit of the background of Chabad generally and of Menachem Mendel specifically and the influences he had on Jews and non-Jews alike. And the Chabad movement continues on. without a successor for one reason or another. We touched upon it a little bit. You can play the blame game from today to tomorrow, but fact of the matter is the Chabad as a movement takes the Rebbe, takes his yesod of spreading Yiddishkeit around the world, and everybody knows what they're doing today. But it's all because of him and because of his vision. So now you know a little bit more about Chabad, more about him, so you can appreciate him as you encounter them, whether it's in the Bahamas or whether it's across the street. You get a little bit of a greater picture of who they are. Okay, thank you for joining me. I know we went over time. I gave you a little bit of a piece of a Dvar Torah from Balak. Obviously, more to talk about. Thank you to the Seagull Balance for sponsoring. Mirtz Hashem, the Neshama should have Aliyahs.
Thank you very much.